We begin this session by acknowledging once again that we are on the traditional, ancestral and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. In our last session, we talked about the conflict that inevitably arises when Indigenous rights are threatened and we hear politicians reference the rule of law, especially when police are involved. But until 1994, it was that same rule of law that forced Indigenous children to go to residential schools, for example. Indigenous communities, Kathleen, are not lawless. They never were. So tell us, what is Indigenous law?
Well, Indigenous law is not a whole lot different than mainstream law in the sense that people want laws to deal with issues in their communities. And you're perfectly correct. I mean, Indigenous peoples have existed for thousands of years, and Indigenous communities cannot survive, they're not sustainable unless there's systems of law to govern behavior, human behavior. So we know that even if we can't find codes, legal codes or whatever, we know that Indigenous peoples have had laws for thousands of years.
My name is John Burrows. I'm the Loveland Chair in Indigenous Law at the University of Toronto Law School, and I'm a member of the Chippewa of the Nawash First Nation. I think people see Indigenous law as a once upon a time process from the past that is about how we used to be as Indigenous peoples. But Indigenous law is a living tradition that enables us to reference our own current concerns about all sorts of modern realities of life. And those concerns, again, can be used to identify what are standards, criteria, measures, authority, standards, principles for resolving disputes. Well, Indigenous law is about creating safety, and it's about creating safety in a way that's got expectations that allow us to understand that things aren't arbitrary in life. And so Indigenous law is about ensuring that a society has patterns of ways of acting so that no one is doing things that aren't without reason.
In the present day context, we know more about Indigenous laws because Indigenous people tell us what those laws are. And they deal with everyday things. They deal with families, they deal with food, they deal with resources, they deal with customs and traditions and ceremonies. And so they're there, they exist. The problem is that when the colonial powers came to North America, they decided that it didn't exist and that they would impose the laws that they had, whether that was French civil law or British common law, that would be imposed, and then they would create legislatures which would continue to make laws to govern Indigenous peoples. The problem with that, of course, is when you have a political structure and a legal structure that does not recognize a certain segment of your population that doesn't understand that structure or doesn't buy into that structure, you get discontent and you get lack of respect for those imposed laws. So that's been a problem for a long, long time, is that Indigenous peoples don't see themselves or their culture reflected in the laws that are imposed upon them.
Phil, can you give us any examples, early memories, if you will, of what Indigenous law may have looked like on your reserve growing up?
We didn't see it as necessarily distinct from the prevailing legal system, other than on matters related to alcohol, murder, and certain assaults. Those were the only three criminal matters that allowed the RCMP to come to the reserve and carry out their responsibilities.
What was the alcohol offense?
The reserves were dry. You weren't allowed to bring alcohol into the reserve. So if it was known that alcohol was being bootlegged, or you had people that, you know, were brewing alcohol, the RCMP were free to come and confiscate what they found and charge the people that were responsible.
Why wouldn't, if I can ask, the Indigenous law have kicked in on that issue within the community itself?
Well, I think when they were negotiating treaty, they expected the government to play the heavy hand when it came to alcohol prohibition, because alcohol was a major factor in trade relations with the Hudson's Bay, the Northwest Company, and various Indian tribes, right, that were involved, heavily involved in trade. The first thing that they would ask is for, we talked about this earlier, about fire water, brandy or rum. And the ceremony included not just the smoking the pipe, but
fire water. You told us all about fire water.
That's right. Yeah. So they knew the harmful effects of alcohol on all of its peoples. They wasted a lot of money. They remained in debt to the trading companies, the Hudson's Bay, Northwest, for pretty much the rest of their life as trappers and hunters. And so they knew that. They wanted the government to police that, so to speak, right? Matters of murder, right? They didn't want to impose their will on their own people. They wanted someone else to judge the crime. And the expectation here was the police. The police were expected to police that matter.
And yet such an acrimonious relationship always between the police and Indigenous people.
So for the longest time, we didn't see police. When I was growing up, the only time I saw the police was on treaty days, because they would come in with their red serge, stand beside the Indian agent that was paying out the money and another government official, and they would be there for the entire 3 days of treaty celebrations on our reserve. They were
a symbol.
They were very seldom seen playing an active role in meeting out justice on the reserve.
When it comes to justice on a reserve, though, is it set by the laws and teachings of every reserve? Is it different?
Well, it depends on the culture. But there are general rules that apply whether you're Mi'kmaq or Ojibwe in Manitoba or Cree in northern Alberta. And there are certain cultural traits that endear you to your law, right? And those have been in place forever. And
restorative justice, of course, is the one that comes to mind. I mean, it's not necessarily an eye for an eye mentality.
When you're engaging in restorative justice, you have to consider the full range of factors. You know, what's best for, of course, the person that's been hurt, what's best for the persons in the community that need continued safety if someone is dangerous in that community. But of course, you're also taking into account the person who's caused the harm and what might be necessary to bring a resolution of whatever trauma is in their life or whatever things that they're not ordering properly, so that you can get them back on a better course, so that they can be people that contribute to the safety of the community rather than taking away from that safety.
Let's say a person has had their purse stolen. The offender and the victim both have to agree to restorative justice. The victim is the center of the process. The offender gets a chance to speak about the purse snatching. Maybe that offender was starving. Maybe that offender was trying to steal money for a sick relative that needed drugs. Who knows? The victim also has, as I said, is center to the process, might talk about how frightened they are now. They can't come out of their house. They're fearful of their neighborhood. They don't feel like they belong anymore because of this incident. So they have a conversation and it's mediated. And so at the end of that process, perhaps this purse snatcher has told the victim he's sorry or she's sorry. They've made some restitution of what was stolen. Maybe the purse has been returned. Maybe they shake hands, maybe they hug. But as a result of that process, the victim feels safe in her own neighborhood because she knows what the offender was thinking. The offender feels to some extent that he's been or she's been forgiven for doing what they've done, and perhaps they've sought some assistance for the reason they stole the purse in the first place. I'm just making it up, but that could be an example. In a First Nations community, restorative justice was started because of lack of prisons in remote communities. And so restorative justice took the form of things like sentencing circles, where the community was asking itself, why is this person acting out? What is it that we're doing or not doing that could be causing this aberrant behavior? So they sit in a circle. If it's a serious matter, there could be a judge from down south, a prosecutor and a defense counsel, but it's not hierarchical. It's equal, an equality-based concept. And again, they would hear from the offender, they would hear from the victim, and the community would have a chance to respond. Members of the community may take responsibility for the offender, say, I will take this person and deal with his or her alcoholism, which perhaps was part of the offense. And I will take them hunting, or I'll take them on a vision quest to help them deal with what problems they're having, or their violent tendencies, or their drinking problem, or whatever. So First Nations have used this, and this was actually made public and popularized by Justice Barry Stewart, who was the Chief Justice in the Yukon, who started this whole process. In fact, was challenged to the Court of Appeal, saying that this judge has gone AWOL and allowing these circle sentences, and when he should be sending people off to jail. And the judge himself, I mean, we've spoken to Barry many times and he's written about this, is that he felt responsible for destroying family relationships and community relationships in Indigenous communities because he was sending all these people to southern jails when they came back hardened criminals. And it didn't help anybody. Which is the story of the criminal justice system in Canada.
Indigenous or non-Indigenous?
But particularly Indigenous people,
it hasn't served them. Incarceration rates.
It's through the roof.
I think it's nine times higher than non-Indigenous rates. Why is that?
Well, there's lots of reasons, but some prisons, they're solely Indigenous.
Provincial jails
that are 100%. The women in particular.
Inmate population is 100% Indigenous. I think it has to do with, it's like an excuse. Cultural differences. Mm-hmm.
Racial profiling.
Racism, profiling. Money, you know.
Inability to meet bail. Inability to get to court, so because of your lack of transportation, so that the charges mount on failure to appear. Residential schools, intergenerational trauma. Alcoholism.
That's interesting because some people that I know that have been in prison, they say, God, we ate better than we did in rest school. That's crude. You know?
No, but I understand the desire to find humor in something like that. But you bring up a really interesting point that I think we should talk about here. Really draw the link because there will be people watching this who say, come on, you can't blame a criminal culture on the Indigenous residential schools, rather. So draw the link on how that would work for intergenerational trauma.
Well, it's been well established now through a lot of studies that children in that setting, they don't have to be Indigenous, where they are brutalized essentially by those that are in the parental role. People being, well, and we've heard the stories, the 6,000 stories that came before the TRC of horrific physical violence and sexual violence. If you grow up in that context, you're learning these parenting skills from the people who are supposed to be parenting you. You're never loved. You're never comforted when you're hurt. You're never sat down and talked to in a kind and loving parental way. So when these children became adults, they didn't have any of that experience that a person growing up in a loving home would have.
So when they had their own children.
When they had their own children, of course, it became problematic in terms of their ability to raise children in a way in which they would feel they belonged, if they would feel comforted and loved. And so, you know, that then translates into antisocial behavior often. It often translates into substance abuse because people self-medicate the lack of emotion, contact, love in their life experience. And so, of course, drug dependency, substance abuse, often leads to crime. We know that. Crime leads to prison, especially in a system like the Canadian criminal code system, which hasn't got much room to have any consideration of cultural differences and context, and so people get sent off to institutions. They come out of institutions after, you know, the university of institutions teaches them further ability how to make crime your life, how to be more violent, how to even be less caring about your fellow human beings. And so it's that kind of a cycle that residential schools created, in the sense of creating an environment where people would emerge from that with real serious issues on that scale.
Does any country present itself as a model on how better to do it? As far as, well, we're talking about Indigenous law. Are there other countries, Australia, for example? Is there anywhere Canada could look to improve this crisis?
They don't have to look to other countries. They can just look to First Nations, because as we just finished talking about restorative justice, that's a concept that comes out of First Nations. And really, our legal system is colonial. It's a colonial practice. And so if we are to open up our understanding of living in a country where you have different legal systems, we've opened that up to the French Civil Code. So we're officially a bi-juridical society, right? With the French law and the British law, and that works. Nobody says it doesn't work. We also know that there's Indigenous law. So really we're a multi-juridical society that doesn't recognize that third system of law. And there's no reason why we shouldn't. And my guess is if we did, and the evidence where some Indigenous law has been respected, the courts are, again, incrementally starting to recognize Indigenous law in election matters and in some family law and in customary adoptions, for example. And it works.
Under Indigenous law, what is the harshest punishment then?
Well, banishment? I mean, back in the olden days, there was the Wendigo type of law, where a Wendigo was considered to be a very dangerous presence in the community.
Explain that.
So that presence could be destroyed. It could be a person that was killing members of the community, let's say. Maybe because of starvation, maybe because of madness. But they could kill a Wendigo, okay? They could get rid of that person. There was also banishment. They could banish certain people from the community if they were a danger to the community, because if that person or that individual was a danger to the collective, the individual would have to go. So that notion of Wendigo or banishment has resurfaced, actually, in some First Nations. In New Brunswick, they've passed a bylaw that's allowing banishment. In Saskatchewan, it's becoming quite regular, and it's being used against gangs and drug dealers who are coming into the community, who are, as individuals, a threat to the community. So chiefs, councils, elders are saying they have to go.
Well, that is easier managed if the community that engages in banishment has its own police force. Because you can banish someone, and if there's no police around to enforce the decision, then it's meaningless. So it is especially important in those areas where communities have their own police authorities to look after such rules. But this became a real problem, I think. I don't know enough about the old days, right? About our people living out in the interland, eking out a living, and I pardon that expression, living off the land, hunting, fishing, trapping. Then in comes the Hudson's Bay and the Northwest Company and others. And their justice system is swift and harsh on Indigenous peoples, especially if they are seen as doing something contrary to the interests of the company. Whether we're talking about the Hudson's Bay Company or Northwest Company. I mean, it wasn't just banishment. They'd execute people. Mm-hmm. They'd execute their trading partners as quickly as they would the people that brought them the supplies.
Indigenous people are still governed by the criminal code in Canada. On a reserve, I'm trying to get a better understanding so that we can all better understand how it would look if there was established law enforcement on a reserve by the people, for the people, so to speak.
It would depend on the reserve and the resources that they have. As we've said, banishment was a technique in remote reserves without prisons. Because if a person is a danger to the community, you want to have something that will remove them from the community, either a jail cell or, in these cases, banishment. And it's interesting to note that recently a Quebec court has approved of a 5-year banishment order that was given by a council of a First Nation in Quebec. So it's not considered to be an inhumane remedy, but as Phil was saying, sometimes it, without having some kind of enforcement, the person banished could just go to the next community and continue doing the harm. But, I mean, many First Nations are perfectly capable of enforcing a criminal code in their own communities and deciding what that should look like and deciding what's deserving of more sanction than other things. Family law is another good example. Why shouldn't the community look after family law issues and children and custody of children and such it, like?
But what we would end up with, in all likelihood, is a combination, a hybrid of what works, for example, in the federal system and apply what works in our community. What works under provincial authorities and apply that in our communities. And what has worked in our communities to come up with a system that is more in keeping with the rights and interests of community A or community B. But the expectation that it would be something completely new and different is impossible. Today, it's impossible. We're just too open as a society. People come and go, move, and they bring with them, wherever they go, their own experiences. When they come back, they have different experiences. And the point that Kathleen made is you send someone out to prison for 10, 15 years, they come back completely different, completely new person.
If people ignore the value of Indigenous law, then we lose a rich source of understanding about how to bring peace to our lives. We also have the danger that there will be more confrontation because people aren't understanding one another, and that confrontation can take away from our economics, can take away from our political possibilities. There's also a danger that if we don't incorporate Indigenous law, that we'll find ourselves with further polarities and further distance, and we really do need to build civility and understanding across our various communities in Canada.
The disparity isn't just incarceration. I mean, it also is that we have to look at the crisis, the epidemic of missing and murdered. These countless stories of loss and trauma for so many families, and how, again, it is so disproportionately impacted by Indigenous women.
My name is Lynn Grew. I am the Executive Director of the Native Women's Association of Canada, and I am a Métis woman from the Métis Nation of Ontario. I've been the CEO Executive Director for 6.5 years.
My name is Paula Halcia Lorelei Williams. I am from Shkati Nations on my mom's side and Stalis on my dad's side. And I do a lot of work around the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
So Indigenous women have been harmed by years of colonial policies that included removing women, children from their communities, from their residential schools. Loss of land, the loss of the culture, the loss of the language has caused a very serious harm to Indigenous women. And the communities today are trying to recover from that.
I have a missing aunt, Belinda Williams. My cousin, Tanya Holick, went missing in 1996. Her DNA was later found on serial killer Robert Pigden's farm. My other cousin, Dorena Green, was taken by a different serial killer, Terry Arnold, and she was raped by him in the mountains when she was only 16 years old. Thankfully, she survived. My other aunt was pushed out of a window in the downtown east side. Thankfully, she survived as well. And so that's why I do the work that I do. There's more stories, you know, there's a lot of, I grew up around a lot of violence. So this is why I think it's important for other people to know about this issue in Canada, because this is a huge issue in Canada.
So the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls came about in 2016. It lasted 3 years until 2019. The Government of Canada decided to have this National Inquiry after being pressured by many of the groups to do so. There was a large number of women, Indigenous women, that had been documented that they were missing and murdered. And this process needed to take place to have the witnesses and testimony come forward. Thousands of witnesses and testimony did come forward. And eventually a report was handed down in 2019 with 231 calls for justice. And these are 231 different ways and initiatives and changes that had to be made to stop the violence against Indigenous women and girls.
We're in survival mode. I could be targeted walking out the store. I could be targeted, because I work with families of MMIWG as well. When we're searching, there's violent men out there.
Well, I think you can go back to the Hudson's Bay. You can go back to the First Indian Act. Women were marginalized by colonialism. Prior to colonialism, they were respected. They fulfilled very important roles in their community, governance-wise, labor-wise. They made alliances. They were interpreters. They did all of those things. But then along came the First Indian Act, and all of a sudden it took away from women the ability to participate in governance. See? So it marginalized them. It took away their ability to be their identity in the sense that it only belonged to the men that they were with. So if a husband abandoned his wife, she lost her Indian status. If she married somebody that wasn't First Nation, she lost her status. So her very identity of being an Indigenous woman was so denigrated by the Indian Act that these women became increasingly marginalized and subjects of derision. The word squaw, for example, was used in government documents, in naming of places, you know, and it was considered to be a very derogatory term, but people used it anyway.
But even before this period, you have to go back again to the all-powerful symbol of greed and capitalism and control, the Hudson's Bay Company, to a lesser extent, the Northwest Company. The senior people, well, not necessarily just the senior people, but all of the people that were affiliated with these companies, lived up north and wherever the company was situated, and they'd take up with women. They'd live with women. They in effect, got married in the custom of the country, I think it was called.
Country marriages.
Country marriages. That's the way it was for the longest time. And so you still have the remnants of that. Governor Simpson, you read about him. He had numerous, numerous children. And he never looked after them.
And remind us again who Governor Simpson is.
Governor Simpson was the head of the Hudson's Bay Company at the height of its power and domination in this part of the world. Before Canada became a country, he rolled with an iron fist from their headquarters to the far north and west, and he had peculiarities about him. For example, he would always want to set speed records. He had his own massive birch bark canoe carved out, and his paddlers were Iroquois people, and they were powerful. They all dressed the same. And they would take him from Montreal to, say, to Fort Alexander and then up to the Hudson's Bay. and they would set speed records. They were incredible. They'd, you know, they'd sing. This guy, when he traveled, wherever he stayed for the night, for example, they brought him a woman. They would bring him a woman, and that was his to enjoy.
And he fathered how many?
Oh, he
What's
fathered,
the rumor?
I've read the book. He fathered dozens and dozens of children. And in his will, he left not a penny for any of these children, but he did for his wife's child.
Non-Indigenous.
Yeah, non-Indigenous. And he wasn't the only one that did that. There are others in the employ of the Hudson's Bay Company that applied the same principles in terms of country wives.
It just speaks to the entitlement, the sense of entitlement and disrespect.
And the burden on the community and the mother and her children. Huge burden.
Yeah, the imposition of degradation, because he would send these women back to their fathers, if they were young girls or young women, knowing that they were with child, and just discard them and go to the next woman. So the families were humiliated by this behavior, because often the father would think, oh, well, if she's with Simpson, that's going to be good for the family. If he marries her in a customary wedding, well, then we will be connected to a very powerful man. But he would discard the women, and he did this across the country. So it humiliated the men when they treated the women this way.
I guess I see
and so
that,
women,
that story.
So women were dehumanized, right? And he wasn't the only one that behaved that way. There were countless others that would take up women wherever they were and have children. And when they would leave that site and go to another one, they'd leave the woman behind with the children to look after themselves. Not every one of them, but most of them.
In our modern era, though, we're talking about women who are murdered, dismembered, thrown on the edges of highways. There is a national inquiry in this country because of this crisis and epidemic. What do you think has changed as a result of that?
I don't think much of anything has changed. The problem is that they had 231 recommendations to address this issue, and very few of those recommendations have been implemented. When the report was made public, what happened? There was just a big argument about whether or not it was genocide. That's the way the media handled it. Nobody looked at what are these women telling us about what their lives look like. That got lost in the shuffle. Why? Maybe was it because people weren't interested? They were more interested to divert the argument in a different direction? Was it too uncomfortable to come to grips with these stories? You know? So again, the marginalization of women has made them and their issues and their lives less important. And that's not different from women, generally speaking, but Indigenous women have been particularly dehumanized, to use Phil's words, because of this generations and centuries of abuse, really. That was the way in which women were treated. And that type of behavior, which was by the leaders of the community, right, the leaders of the fur trade, set an example. So if you look at Alberta, the whiskey trade, for example, Fort McLeod, you know, it was known for being a place where you could abuse women, Indian women. And very few of these so-called marriages ever resulted in any responsibility being taken for the children or the wife. They would go off to the next destination and, you know, in the travels. And so when you have a history of this, it's really quite easy for that history to continue in the modern era without something to stop that attitudes, because attitudes are handed down. Just like stereotypes are handed down, the stereotype of the Indigenous woman as being available, as being loose, as being immoral, etc., those stereotypes have stayed. We can see it in court decisions. There was that horrific case in Edmonton where this woman was I'm not even going to get into the details. They were so horrible. But the court case demonstrated how disrespectful the legal system was of this woman's body, even, you know. So, Lisa, you can't just freeze a point in time and say, what's the problem today with murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls? You have to look back into the context of the way they've been treated over time.
The government called that national inquiry really to fulfill one of the 94 calls by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What was it, number 41, to be specific? So in our next session, we're going to discuss the TRC's calls to action as a way to move forward. Ooh, away, 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 away.